Hey everyone, this is the Meat Eater Podcast. We're recording in Madison, Wisconsin. I'm here with Doug Duren from Madison. Are you from Madison or Cazenovia?
I'm from Cazenovia, but I live in Madison.
Yeah, Doug's from Cazenovia, which is like the redneck stepchild to Madison, right?
That's a pretty accurate description.
Did you grow up hating people from Madison because you were from Cazenovia?
No, I spent a lot of time here. We used to come down here like when I was in high school and stuff.
Yeah, Doug's from a farm family, an ag family. His dad, I've hunted on Doug's a handful of times, and I spend more time in Wisconsin than I do in my home state now. And Doug's dad was a rural mail carrier, right?
That's right.
Funny story about Doug's dad. One time someone made some calls trying to accuse Doug's dad of being a communist because he had delivered some magazines called Red Book.
Free sample of Red Book magazine, yeah.
They thought he was spreading communist propaganda.
Well, that and some other things that had gone on, you know, politically in the area. But, yeah, and if you don't know, Red Book magazine is a woman's magazine. So I expected something like this.
He's like, I knew it. Yeah. Red Book, commie. Here with Remy Warren. We're mainly talking with Remy. Also here with Giannis Poutelis. A little known fact about Giannis Poutelis is right now he has poison ivy on his pecker. We just got back from turkey hunting in California, and where we were hunting, is it predominant or prominent? If I was going to say the blank undergrowth.
Predominant?
How about pervading?
The pervading undergrowth. It's like a lot of places you go and you'd be like, oh, there's some poison oak or poison ivy. This place, it was just everything that wasn't a tree was poison oak.
There was like trees, grass.
Poison oak. It was the prevailing, predominant, prominent, dominant.
You know, you didn't have to vegetation. Make a suit out of it, though.
So yeah, Yanni made himself a little like a little ghillie suit out of poison oak. No, I don't know. We did
blended right in.
I wanted to hide. You know,
I've gotten that stuff so bad in the past. I've gotten that stuff so bad that I had to go to the emergency room for having bad fevers because we were burning at one time.
Hey.
We were clearing a lot in Indiana and burned a bunch of that stuff, and I'd breathe it in, and it wasn't hours later, and I just got a very bad fever. And since then, I've always had a problem with it. But the weird thing about this time is initial exposure was 8 days ago, and I just got my first blister this morning. But Yanni's had it on his tallywhacker since.
Maybe it's just sympathetic symptoms. Where
it could
like,
be.
You're just feeling for him a little bit. So you're like, look, right here.
It seems like
itchy.
In our crew, we're about 50% that got it. And
no, everybody's saying they did not get it.
No, because you now have a spot.
Well, so yeah, but I don't count that as having it.
Oh, okay. Well, then it's just 20%.
Well, no.
Mike had it.
Callen, nothing. I thought Mike said nothing.
No.
Oh, Mike said his forearms.
He's got it on his forearms. He sent me a picture. It's pretty good on his forearms.
Oh, it is. God, I hate that stuff.
Yeah, it's wicked. I made it about 4 or 5 days, really like strong mentally, and just been holding off, not scratching at all. And at 3 o'clock this morning, I just woke up, and I even put Band-Aids over like the worst ones so that I couldn't scratch while I was asleep. And I woke up like ripping the Band-Aids off.
Just
unconsciously.
Because you wanted to get a good
scratch.
Before
I actually woke up, I was already pulling them off.
Dude, the last time I had it bad was, I told this story 100 times, but I skinned a wild pig that had been rolling in it, and it was just immediate. It was like the next day, I just had sleeves of it, my waistline. I could see how I tucked my shirt in.
Oh.
And like actually like finger lines where I had like tucked my wool undershirt in, like finger lines running down my abdomen, had it on my scrow, had it on my tallywhacker. Had it just everywhere, just awful. And then we went to hunt in Montana after that, and it's like below zero. So you're laying in your sleeping bag, just so you know it's cold, but it's just like, I hate that stuff, man.
That seems like the worst.
But Yanni's got it pretty good now, and we were taking every precaution. Like we'd hunt, and you couldn't not. You'd either have to not hunt. right? The only way to avoid it would be to not hunt. So we hunted turkeys quite successfully. And we'd come back and just take off your pants and boots. Wash your clothes. Anytime I touched my boots, I would tie my boots in the morning, scrub the piss out of my hands. When I took my boots off at night, scrub the piss out of my hands. I kept two or three layers on at all times. I feel like I still feel like I defeated it, but it could come out 14 days later.
Yep. When I was blacktail hunting down there, and I did the same, you know, I was just camping though, so I just had a pair of gloves that I always wore. Anytime I was touching any of my clothes or anything, it was like, put the leather gloves on. But then I shot some mountain quail with my bow, and see the arrow laying over there. I was like, no, that's good, because I thought next time I draw that arrow back to be touching my face.
You're going
to
get it on
your
teeth.
I was like, yeah, those are expensive birds to shoot at. I was like, no, I'm not picking those arrows
Man, back up. I think the next time I do it, I was thinking about every time I've hunted there, every time I hunted in California, I've gotten them in this area. You know, I was thinking about trying to use bringing a shitload of latex gloves.
Yeah, I think that would work.
Just all day long, man. Have like a Ziploc baggie and just all day long be like, put latex gloves on and just periodically taking the things off, put a new set of latex gloves on, taking them off.
That'd probably work. Because it's always on your – it's from your hands. Yeah, or your clothes, that oil.
Like right now I can feel some – it hasn't done anything, and usually it does not. I can feel it on my face, but I got some where it pops up where your skin's thin. So like my eye socket, I can feel it right here for sure.
I bring those alcohol wipes too. Yep. I think that helps like get
they say isopropyl alcohol cut that oil. When you get poison oak, what's happening? And this is something we were talking about, Doug. My understanding right now, and I want to look this. Someone should look this up.
I was just doing that.
Is it poison oak and poison ivy? There's no difference.
Are poison ivy and poison oak the same thing?
What source you on?
I'm on answers.com.
They ought to call it bullshit.
No, is the answer. Oh. Poison ivy, toxic chondron radicans, and poison oak, toxic chondron.
Oh, they look different,
really?
Too, don't
diverse
they?
But I thought it was a unbroken cline of intergrades across the species range.
I really liked that when you said that earlier. I was like, wow, he really knows what he's talking about.
Yeah, but he's been throwing that like every
time. I read that term, so I've been trying to use it whenever possible.
I have this
unbroken cline of intergrades. You can picture what that means, right? It'd be like you got some bird that's everywhere, but like you look at one in California.
The wild turkey's a good example.
Yeah.
Gotcha.
For instance, the wild turkey, the Osceola turkey in the eastern, there's no genetic barrier. Like an Osceola turkey is what is known as a subspecies of the wild turkey. In the Florida Peninsula. What? You can't see it, but Doug's giving this face, like this, like, oh, here we go face.
I was just thinking about a conversation that Addis and I had earlier about, I want to hear about Doug's purple Suburban, but first let me tell you about Doug's purple Suburban. It was...
Oh.
Sorry.
No, please. It's only my podcast.
I know it's your podcast.
All right. So... unbroken cline of intergrades. Eastern turkeys look different than Osceola turkeys, but there's no gap. There's no like gap where one ends and the other begins. The same thing with mule deer and Columbia blacktails. According to Boone and Crockett, it's I-5. West of I-5, he's a blacktail. East of I-5, he's a mule deer. You could go from being a blacktail to a mule deer just by crossing the highway. Unbroken cline of intergrades. They look different. All right, what were we saying now?
Well, they're not the same, but they are related.
Is that right? All right, I believe it.
And it's the resin that is
the
same.
Is the resin the same?
Yeah, but then we'd have to get a taxonomist or to talk about this, but they aren't, you know, same genus, different species, different family.
Different family.
Yeah.
Yeah, Jennifer was...
So I think you're right.
Oh, you know what? Giannis's wife's a botanist. What'd she say?
Yeah, different family, the two of them. And then poison sumac is a whole other one.
Yeah, well, I know that.
See, I always thought poison oak...
But it's all
Urushiol. The same.
Or however you pronounce that, the oil.
They all bring the same oil? All right, good. I stand corrected.
No.
Even the blind squirrel's wrong now and then.
I was going to say that you were right. Steve's right.
How?
Well, in that they're related.
Oh, okay. All right, let's move on.
Everybody's right.
Remy, you're just off the plane from New Zealand.
Yeah.
All right. I want to give because I want to talk about New Zealand for a minute.
All right,
but I want to bring, but I want to like bring list. I want to talk to. I'm going to address listeners for a minute. You correct me when I'm done. You correct me where I'm wrong.
All right, I'm taking notes.
New Zealand's a big ass island in the Pacific. It's like a continent-y kind of island, giant. It's actually two primary islands, about the size
of California.
Yeah, so
both islands.
The only native mammal that New Zealand had were some bats. Pre. Arrival of humans. The first humans to go there were the Maori, right?
They were not the first humans, but they were the most
successful.
Correct. Yeah.
Polynesians.
Yeah. I mean, apparently the Maori, they took over the island, and then they, because there wasn't a lot of food, so then eventually they used the original native people as food source.
They were big into cannibalism, putting people out on islands and stuff.
Yeah, but they, that's because they essentially extinct their food source, which was a moa, giant.
Yeah, giant that's what I want to get to. Yeah. So New Zealand had no mammals except for some bats, and they had birds that filled all the niches or niches. If you want to sound like you know more what you're talking about, they had birds that filled all like the mammal niches. So they had like giant grazers, 400, 500 pound birds.
Yeah, and then top predator was the Haast eagle, which ate a 500-pound bird. So that's like, that is a giant eagle.
That's a bear. Well, that's what my kid would call a bad mofo.
And then that Natural History Museum, have you ever been there in, what's the main big town at the bottom of the North Island?
Auckland.
Auckland? This is the capital, right?
Yep.
Yeah. I think it's the Natural History Museum. We went there. They have a recreation of a cave, and it's like, it's like a hole in the ground right below the ground level where one of those eagles had caught a moa and then crashed into there, and the bones were like on top of each other.
Oh, really?
So they had it kind of recreated in there.
You're kidding.
Yeah, giant.
Oh, that's
giant.
Nice. Giant. All right, so New Zealand, there's a problem with islands where when people colonize islands, they tend to eradicate, you know, all the wildlife. Like it happened in the Hawaii Islands, like the Polynesians when they arrived in Hawaii. Led many, many, many extinctions. And one problem is they show up with rats, you know?
Yeah.
They show up with rats. People tend to show up places with pigs. Causes all manner of problems. So when people of Polynesian descent show up in New Zealand, and like everything, it just crashed. Like the place crashed.
Pretty much, yeah. They just
ecological.
Ran out of food. Yeah. And then
all those big birds were very vulnerable to overhunting.
Yeah.
Later, you know, the Brits show up. And I was just reading about this the other day. The Brits, the British, had these committees. You know how, like, nowadays you belong to a conservation organization? Like, I'm a member of a handful of conservation organizations. And the goal of a conservation organization would be that you conserve, generally, like, you're conserving native wildlife. Pheasants Forever is a conservation organization that tries to conserve an introduced bird, the pheasant. You know, pheasants aren't from here. They're from Asia. When the British were in New Zealand, they had these things called acclimatization organizations. It's an organization dedicated to trying to make New Zealand seem familiar to Europe.
Everybody wants to feel like they're at home. Let's
and
go across the world.
Their goal was
like
to bring in, yeah, they were organizations based around bringing in and introducing wildlife
and plants and other things.
Everything.
There's the worst plant. There's gorse. It's like, let's bring a plant that every time you walk past it, it pokes you and then causes rashes.
Was it intentionally brought in?
I think so. Just another, I mean, I don't know for a fact, but it could have just been a byproduct of bringing in some other animals or other things.
It came out on accident.
Yeah, there's just a ton of plants like that that have no.
Yeah, well, like point. Spotted knapweed here, yeah. We have tons of stuff here that was accidentally that rolled in on wheat seeds.
Yeah.
You know?
Or thistles, all kinds of stuff.
So in New Zealand, they introduced everything. A lot of things stuck. And now in New Zealand, you go hunting there and you're not hunting native wildlife. But it in New Zealand, an environmentalist is someone who wants to kill all the wildlife.
Pretty much, yeah.
Because there's a big movement to, particularly with predators, because they have a lot of small, no, they don't have any big predators. They have a lot of small predators, weasels, skunks, the omnivorous.
No skunks.
Possum.
But stoats.
Oh, not skunks.
There's stoats. There's
which
there's
is the ermine.
Feral cats, weasels, ferrets.
No skunks, though.
Stoats. And then possums, but they aren't opossums. They're
red possum.
Yeah, they're an Australian. It's used. The possums were actually brought over for. It's like they put it in with the wool. They mix it with the wool.
Gotcha.
So when you shoot a possum, you can actually pluck them while they're still warm. Yeah, so you mix it with sheep wool, and it's like gives it this cashmere feel. It's super, super soft fur.
Oh, gotcha.
Pretty cool pelts. Huh.
So they did that, and they got a big prop rats too.
Yeah, rats, rabbits, hares, those are the worst.
Yeah, problems. So yeah. New Zealand's got this big struggle where they're like, you know, it would be a goal if you asked like a conservationist or an environmentalist of some sort in New Zealand, it would be a goal that you'd clear the island of all non-natives and somehow start rehabilitating all the lost species, many of which are gone forever, like you won't get them back. But there's a lot of endangered birds there and stuff. And hunting there's weird because on one hand, the government's out gunning animals from helicopters.
And poisoning with 1080 cereal poison. So you've got kind of, everyone's like, oh, there's no predators, no limits, no seasons. But you've got government guys shooting them from helicopters, people poisoning areas, like, and everybody hunting all the time. Yep. It's just a
no close season. Yeah, there's like no close seasons, no bag limits. Your competition isn't so much other hunters as it's government sharpshooters shooting out of helicopters.
Yeah.
It's just a wild place to hunt. I had a great time. If viewers of the show Meat Eater might, you know Remy from the various things he's involved in, but we did four episodes, very well received episodes of Meat Eater that we shot in New Zealand, hunting with Remy. And what you spent what time there?
About 3 months, like March, April, May, a little bit in June.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know what? I know I got a buddy in Anchorage. One thing about New Zealand, like when you see if you see a TV host type personality guy go over to New Zealand, he shoots a giant stag.
Oh yeah.
Always it's a penned up animal. So what
Every
they do
time.
Is they raid, but well, except I'm going to tell you about a dude I know.
Okay.
So they raise stags, like red deer, okay? They raise them in order to, for many things, meat, but also to harvest the velvet for aphrodisiac markets in Asia.
Well, and joint medicine is a lot of it.
Oh, so it's not aphrodisiac?
It's like human performance stuff.
Oh, is that what the velvet's for?
A lot of times, yeah.
Oh, you know what? Yeah, okay.
Yeah, so, I mean, I'm sure it is aphrodisiac stuff, but they use, I guess they use, recently we've been asked to collect the tails. I guess there's a gland in the tail that they use, like dried up, something
gotcha.
Like that, on like while they're rutting, this gland.
So they sell it then?
Yeah, but the, yeah, you can make like, there's something that's good for your joints.
So they raise deer, like it's profitable, the velvet's valuable enough where you can raise deer just to pull velvet and sell it.
Yeah. Oh yeah.
And when a stag gets, I'm so paranoid about ticks. I'm still like checking my head for ticks. Places turkey hunt.
Mine's playing ticks on you.
Ticks, man. Yeah, mine's playing ticks on me. That's good. So when a stag gets to be like as big as he's gonna get, right?
Yeah.
They'll sell it to a guy who runs hunts. They'll put it in a truck and drive it over and turn it loose in his little penned area. Then a dude will come out, and he'll be like, they'll be like, well, how much do you want to spend? And what's the cost if you want to shoot a 400-inch stag?
About $12,000, somewhere around there.
And they'll charge you based on the – you'd be like, oh, I want to spend 10 or 12, and they'll show you which one to shoot. I have an idea for New Zealand. I brought this up with you before. You know, they have like range-finding binoculars?
Yeah.
I want to make a rifle scope. This will be good for Texas and New Zealand, a barcode-reading rifle scope where – as you're aiming at the animal, like when you're hunting a high wire place in Texas, they'll use it in Africa. When you're aiming at the animal, it shows you what it costs at the bottom of your scope.
That guy could actually, you could just set it straight to my iPad or whatever, and then they can just like adjust the price as your heart rate goes up. You know?
That probably wouldn't work for their advantage, though, for the guides, for the people trying to make the money, because I feel like they're always like, yeah, that one's so much, this one's a little bit more, and he's like, no, I can't afford that one, and then the guide says, well, just look at him through the scope, you know, and so then you look at him through the scope, and you go, oh, yeah, he looks good. Now, I feel like if that price tag was blinking right there, you'd be like, nah, no.
That's my wife gonna think.
Yeah, no, that's probably a good point. So, I was watching a guy I've always admired. There's a guy, I don't want to name his name. I've always admired him. And I was watching him hunting in New Zealand. And he's just sitting there, and it's just like giant stag after giant stag after giant stag. I'm like, this dude's hunting like a penned up spot.
Yeah.
But there's this guy I know in Anchorage who was just in New Zealand hunting tar.
Okay.
And he killed a bull that scored in the 390s wet score, and he said his guide was shocked that they found it.
Was it private land?
No.
Public land.
Oh, that I don't know, but it wasn't in the fence.
Well, yeah. He
got away?
I call them escaped convicts. Yeah. Oh. yeah, it's an escaped convict. Because depending on where he's tar hunting, you just aren't going to find them that big. They just don't grow that big in the wild. I mean, it's not. I would say like the real world record is probably in the 330s.
Okay.
Yeah.
That's how big he'd get on a free range place.
Yeah. I mean, that's if they were only well managed. I mean, maybe they could get a little bigger, but yeah, it's an escaped.
Yeah.
So is it supplemental feed that mostly makes them a lot bigger, or just letting them get
supplemental?
It's
the same thing as deer or anything. It's breeding, feed combination. When they breed them up, you could have a first year stag, like after, you know, spike, second year, 2 year old that scores 400.
Oh, really?
Yeah, oh, yeah. Like these ones that they grow to.
Selectively bred.
Yeah. Apparently they just grew like a new world record. I don't even know what that means really. But, and it was, I can't even remember the numbers, but it's over 700 inches.
No one's going to accept. Like a trophy type place, no one's going to accept the score, right?
If it's, SCI
if it's
does,
a fenced
right?
animal.
Yeah, they have like a special category for fenced animals. But that's why with them raising so many true wild, my thought is your record should be public land only. And then, you know, there's going to be the occasional dude that shoots one that just escaped. And those guys know. They'd just be like, well, this isn't a wild deer.
You.
And so, you know, but you can tell like a real big, most stags that are wild are big 12 or 14 pointers. But it's funny because you could be on one of these high fence deals and you'll see these, you know, giant 400 inch stags, but then there'll be some wild ones that they just cannot kill out of there.
Oh, really?
So yeah. And you see them and they could be like good wild ones, and they see death all the time. Those are probably the hardest to kill animal you can find
in the
world,
because they just know.
I had a friend that's like, he had this wild one jump into his little operation there, or I don't know, maybe he was born in there, who knows. And I mean, it'd been in there for like 5 years and they couldn't kill it. It's crazy. I mean, because it just live in the thick bush, and it just seen every animal on the place get slaughtered. So he's like, yeah, he's like, go in there and shoot it for me because it's killing my big stags. I was like, oh yeah, this should be no problem. It took me 5 days
to find them.
To find it. It was crazy. Huh. I was like, huh, okay. But that's, I mean, I'm not, you know, obviously I don't hunt high fence stuff, but I went in there to go take care of a problem for a guy and thought to myself, what's harder, going on public land where there's 30 stags per square mile or go on this one place
where there's
one stag per 20, you know, 20, oh, I don't even know how big the place was, you know, 1,000 acres in one stag, or go on the wild property where there's 20 stags per 1,000 acres, you know?
Yeah.
It's like, okay, that took a lot longer. And it was frustrating because you're like, this should be easy. This is stupid.
Yeah,
I was just getting pissed off.
The most exciting thing I did, and this, I know it's something you like the most in New Zealand, is you can do that, right? There's plenty of red deer hunting. But there's also just a lot of crazy animals just living out in the...
Oh, yeah. Well, out. I mean, for me, if I'm going to hunt for myself, I'm going to go tar hunting. It's just the country. It's like, okay, I can go on a doll sheep type hunt, mountain goat type hunt, whatever, just on the weekends for fun every week.
Yeah,
whatever.
It's amazing.
the country is really what it's all
public
about.
Public land.
Oh, yeah.
Open stuff. We just like, oh, it's just, you just like drive up these areas, and it's just a matter of like what you're willing to hike.
Yeah.
You know? We ran into chamois. We went through private land to access. We were hunting public land, I think.
No, the road. Well, the road goes through. The road was like an easement through.
But it's open to anybody.
Yeah. Okay. No, anybody can drive that road.
Oh, really? Oh.
Yeah, we just.
Well, it wasn't even a road, really.
Yeah, you just.
We just kind of drove up. Basically, you're just driving on gravel moraines and stuff up into the mountains.
Yeah, because the river's. It's just like, you know, Montana. River's public. Is between the high water marks, so that's why we drive up the river.
So yeah, we were there. I don't want to tell you where it is because you'd be screwing Remy over. But we went into a place to hunt, and we drove 20 miles,
20 to 30 miles, yeah,
up a river, like just driving up river, like very careful. You can kind of see where vehicles will go. There's a lot of gravel, just like eskers and moraines, gravel bars. You can kind of see now and then. You'll see like a route. Sometimes you can't find the route. You just pick your way up this river. It'd be just like driving up a big braided gravel stream channel, 20 miles. And it was almost kind of arbitrary where we stopped. It was like you couldn't really go any further.
Well, there's a point where walking is a lot faster.
Yeah.
But you want to get as far as you can because we had obviously a lot of gear, camera equipment. It's like, might as well drive up as far as we can and then walk from there.
Yeah, so we got where we couldn't go any further. And then it's not far up there. Everything, it just turns into glaciers.
Yeah.
But you hike from there, and you're glassing from the valley floor. And you're glassing up and seeing chamois.
Which was rare where we were at. That's like my little secret spot.
A rare little pocket of chamois. And you're seeing tar. But it'd be like, you're seeing them, but you're seeing them, and it's a day investment to go even begin to try to find one.
Yeah.
But you don't even need a hunting license.
No, well, you kind of do.
Oh, what do you need?
It's just this thing. You don't buy it, but you fill it out online. So they call it a hunting license. Yeah. There's nothing we would think of as a hunting license.
Yeah, there's no like non-resident tag.
Yeah, you have to have this special permit that says, oh, I can be in this area.
Is it free? Hunting.
Yes, it's free.
Okay.
Just online. I know some of that stuff might change in the future, but as it is right now, you just boom, pop online.
It's interesting because they get you for the fishing tag.
Well, yeah, fishing. You got to pay for, and duck shooting. You have to have a hunting license for, but not geese. Geese because they deregulated geese.
Yeah, I shot a goose with a rifle there.
Oh yeah,
which feels fun.
Is a weird,
very weird feeling.
Yeah, last time I was up that, I go up that canyon quite a bit just because it's close to where I'm at, and I got a double on geese with my rifle. I was pretty excited.
Lined them up.
Yeah.
I got a buddy, and he's like a crack commando of a hunter. He's a guide, and he's a doll sheep guide. He just rounded up a couple friends, and they went to New Zealand just all on their own.
Yeah.
He just did a bunch of research, talked to everybody he could think of to talk to, and just like hunted public land. One of them got a stag. Everybody got tar.
I sent him into my tar spot.
Oh, did you?
Yeah.
Oh, you know what I'm talking about.
Oh, yeah. He had a good hunt up. The place that I always go, it's just kind of like, just like anywhere, I'd rather hunt the same place five times than a new place every time.
Yeah.
Because you just get to learn the ins and outs of it. And they saw some, he was telling me about the stag they saw in there. I was like, why didn't you shoot it, man? He's like, oh, I don't know. It just didn't seem big enough. And I went back in there right after they left looking for it.
Try to find it.
Never found it.
Oh,
yeah.
Really?
Yeah.
It was on public land?
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Yeah. New Zealand's a trip, man. But here's the thing. I liked it, but it was hard for me because there's no the animals are missing their sort of context, their sort of historical context.
But maybe it's because you aren't around the culture so much.
Yeah.
Because for me, I go there and I understand where they're coming from. Like I've seen the videos and heard the stories from the old timers, and the animals in New Zealand have a very important role in the culture and the culture of hunting. Because, well, obviously, okay, they're non-native, but how many non-natives do we enjoy here? Brown trout and pheasants and, all kinds of things. And so over there, the culture of hunting is just different. You got to, look at it through the lens of a native-born Kiwi hunter where they were
not one who hunts Kiwis.
Correct, yeah. Essentially, it is based on culling animals, where the animals were released and then they started to overpopulate.
Because there's no big predators.
Correct. And so hunting was, they would go out and they would shoot for meat and control the numbers. And then it became a huge meat market thing where they would go and shoot the animals and sell them. And then you got into this era.
Yeah, these guys feed their, like, you'll go to a guy that owns dogs. He'll just have like a little closet. He just they'll just shoot animals.
That's where you feed your animals with.
They just cut chunks of meat off and throw it in the dog pen. It's just like, imagine an inexhaustible supply of meat that was always available to you.
Yep. You never had to worry about. And so you go there and like venison is so accepted there. Whereas in America, it's like this, it's a hip thing or a new thing or something hunters eat. Now everybody eats venison there. That's meat. Like,
yeah.
That's what you eat because it's everywhere. You don't have to go out and like everybody knows somebody that can go shoot meat.
You know, you raise a point that I've actually thought of because I mull this over my head all the time when you mention pheasant brown trout. Like for instance, I was brought up in Lake Michigan, and across the lake we're in Wisconsin right now. I was growing up in Michigan on Lake Michigan, and we grew up fishing steelhead, coho, king salmon. Okay,
yeah.
Now, a guy might have come out from California, Alaska, and said to me, but dude, these are just introduced.
Yeah.
But to me, it was like just an ingrained part of culture. And it wound up being that I knew, like academically, it's like, yeah, they're not from here, but they're from here because they've always, like, from my perspective,
they've
born in 1974, they were just here.
Yeah.
You know? And it's like, yeah, sure, I accept that they're non-native. And you think about, like, people. You might hunt pheasants in some place your grandpa hunted pheasants.
Exactly.
It winds up being so, but that's what I'm saying. Like for a stumbling block for me going to New Zealand was like let me just put it this way. If I go, let's say I go up to hunt caribou. Okay, I'm very interested in sort of the ecological history of caribou, traditional use patterns among indigenous hunters. Right.
Right.
The way the animal like. The way it just tied into things about how the first Americans who ever crossed the Bering Land Bridge were probably caribou hunters, right? I find pleasure in that. It makes things like relatable to me in a deep sense. To go to New Zealand from an outside perspective, I just felt like, yeah, but you just let all this stuff go.
Yeah, but
it felt like it was yesterday.
But it's not.
It's not.
There's been, you know, it's like, okay, I drew a. And I could be wrong about this, but I'm pretty sure. Well, no, actually, yeah. Red deer in New Zealand have been there longer than elk have been in the state of Nevada. So you draw this coveted Nevada elk tag,
yeah.
And you're like, woohoo, I just shot a big elk in Nevada, and you don't even think twice about it. Yet you go to New Zealand, and the deer have been there twice as long.
Yeah. That's right, folks. The Meat Eater Podcast brought to you by the New Zealand Chamber of Commerce.
Yeah.
No, you raise a valid point, dude. You raise a valid point.
But it's just when you start talking, if you talk to people that grew up in that culture, I mean, there's so much history of the people there in that hunting and the animals and what it means to them that you respect. You're like, okay, you grew up doing this, and they have the stories of back when they were shooting them, putting them on helicopters and taking them out overloaded and like – guys going into Fjordland and these wild, wild places trying to hunt elk and other things. There's actually moose released there. It's kind
They've
of like our Bigfoot. Yeah. Now, I don't. It's one of those things where people keep seeing moose tracks every once in a while, but there really are probably no moose left.
Are they that good at trackers?
I don't know. There's some pretty good hunters. And imagine being able to hunt all the time in mountainous, rough terrain and not having.
Yeah, and they all do it
seasons,
short.
Limits, whatever. I mean, these guys are probably some of the best hunters in the world, to be honest.
Yeah, that dude that we went pig hunting with.
Darren.
He's been around the block.
Oh, yeah. And, I mean, the guy's killed thousands and thousands of animals.
And that bush is rough.
It is rough.
The mountains are way rough.
Oh, yeah.
That was some of the sketchiest ground I've ever hunted big game on.
Oh, it's crazy. I went to a place, was it last year? And I mean, I had to cross these glaciers and everything. It's like, where else can you go do that besides maybe the Himalayas and few places in Alaska?
Yeah.
And go hunt a species that can't be hunted anywhere else in the world, really. The Himalayan tar, at least.
All right, Remy wins.
Let's take a quick break to give a quick shout out to one of our supporters, Wealthfront.
All right. If you like listening to Meat Eater Podcast for free, you have to pay special attention to what I'm saying because it's like these boys at Wealthfront help keep Meat Eater Podcast free and widely available. It's an automated investment service that makes it easy to invest your money the right way. So if you want to grow up to be a guy that just hunts and fishes all the time, listen to what I'm saying. Wealthfront software manages your money using investment strategies that used to be available just like super wealthy investors for just about one quarter of the cost of using a traditional advisor. And Wealthfront monitors your account around the clock 24/7, and they automatically rebalance your portfolio, reinvest dividends, and maximize after-tax returns. Again, man, I'm talking about getting where you don't have to work and you just hunt and fish. You got to invest. I used to not be good about it, but I'm better about it now. Launch us back in, Eddie.
What were we on? New Zealand. Crazy bush hunters.
All right, so yeah, you've made all kinds of money on Wealthfront, and now you're going to go. Seriously, though, do you guys worry about your future? Like, do you do anything to save for the future?
Wait, you're saying stockpiling meat in the freezer isn't good enough?
If it depends on, you got to watch the prices. You got to wrap it right so it's still saleable later. Because I have a forced investment thing now. Like, you ever heard of a SEP, like a tax thing?
No.
Every year when I do my taxes, they make you, like, save some money.
Oh, yeah.
Mm. So I finally have, like, money.
Yeah.
It's only because there's a gun to my head. You know? They're, like, basically, like, you can either save it or give it to us. And I'm like, well, I'll save it. You're basically deferring paying taxes.
Which, nothing wrong with that.
No. So well, I'm old.
Three kids, Steve, I think probably saving would be a good idea. You know, the whole college
thing. Now you got. I feel like you got to save for the bicycles. Like, I feel like I'm buying a new bicycle every 2 weeks now.
We just
bought the new Strider bike, you know? I was telling you. Yeah, my 3.5-year-old gets a new Strider bike like 6 weeks ago. We're striding along. Everything's going great. She can coast it. Well, she just grabs a pedal bike from her daycare because she wouldn't leave it alone. So the daycare owner was just like, look, just take this thing home. It's all beat up and rusty. She gets home, puts her feet on it, starts pedaling it. Now that thing's so beat up that she's like, I need a bigger one. Look at the bike that girl's got. So
yeah.
Never ends.
No. And you can't really deny them because it's like exercise. Like, you could be like, no, I'm not buying you a blank.
Oh, and the
you know what? There's a housekeeping dude. We're recording in a hotel and the housekeeping guy's banging out here. Doug, you talk to those guys?
I'll take care of them.
Sorry?
No, I was just saying that the Cheshire cat grin on her face when she's riding that bike, I'd buy her as many bikes as she could ever want.
No, I totally understand where you're coming from. You know, I was saying, we had a Strider and my kids smoked the bearings out of it. I don't want to talk about New Zealand anymore because I want to talk about something different. But
yeah.
Anyone have any concluding thoughts, Doug? What? Concluding thoughts?
It was a question. And
Doug primarily hunts the same patch of ground he grew up on.
Yeah, very much. Yeah, that's exactly right. I wondered about, you said that the government was poisoning and they're sharpshooters and all this. Why don't they introduce predators?
Oh, well, they actually
have a whole new problem.
So during,
well, I know.
Because they're raising sheep.
No, during World War II, well, that's a problem. So the rabbits were a problem. So they introduced the weasels and the ferrets. Well, the weasels and the ferrets decided that the native flightless bird species are way easier to kill and eat than rabbits.
That's what, when they brought in in Hawaii, they had the rat. They brought in the mongoose to take care of the rats.
And just ate all the
mongoose is just devastated ground nesting birds.
So you can't get them to focus on the particular species.
This will piss someone off, but the writer Tom Robbins was talking about the rat mongoose thing in Hawaii, and he said, we used to have a crime problem when we brought in cops.
I just found this out recently, though, that during World War II, when all the men were away fighting, the deer population just exploded.
They actually
thought about bringing in mountain lions.
No way.
Yeah. That was a legitimate solution
to
the problem.
I would have been all for it, man.
Yeah. Well, imagine the shepherds, though.
Yeah.
What are the deer going to eat now? Or what are the lions going to eat?
Yeah. I would have been for it because I would have been like, listen, it's a crazy zoo now anyway. Yeah. Let's just go
bring
for it.
I think they should bring
it. Let's just do it.
Bengal tigers. Might as well be something that's semi-endangered, or highly endangered. We've got enough mountain lions. Let's set some Bengal tigers loose.
Yeah, here's the thing. I want to do, as for my own wrap-up on New Zealand, I want to do my own thing. One thing I felt about New Zealand, and I had a blast there, and I'll remember it all the time. I hunted a red deer in England, and if I could scrub the memory from my mind, I would scrub it from my mind. No, yeah. I hunted a red deer in Scotland. If I could scrub it from my memory, I would.
Because it just wasn't.
I just didn't care about it.
Yeah.
It wasn't exciting to me. The system there is not exciting to me.
Yeah.
It's like you can only hunt like
with the gamekeeper.
The game's all privately owned. You go out with the gamekeeper. He's not even supposed to let you touch the gun until he lines it up.
Yeah.
It's just like, yeah, it's like old world. It scrubs all the adventure from hunting and turns into they get dressed up in special clothes.
But see, that hunting's about the adventure for me, and New Zealand is
way
adventure.
Yeah, listen, like, that's what I was going to try to say. Way adventure.
Oh yeah,
it's a 30 miles plane ride.
Up, 30 miles up a river valley. Well, can I tell one of my favorite stories that has ever happened out hunting?
Yeah, if you count it as your wrap up.
Yeah. Okay. With 30 miles up the river valley. Remember, we sent when you were here.
Oh,
the story
tell
with,
that story.
Yeah, that story. Nobody's heard this story.
No, no.
This is
a
very behind the scenes into the workings and dealings of Meat Eater. And so,
this is a great story.
You shoot your chamois, and my buddy Ben, who came over from Australia, he's just hunting around, and so I said, hey, we need some guys to carry equipment, do a little packing. So we've got Aussie Ben carrying cameras and recharging batteries. So we shoot the chamois, and then we send Ben back to the vehicles to charge some batteries. And I'm thinking,
it's past dark.
Yeah, it's past dark, and we're back at the hut cooking up dinner, and I'm like, man, where is Ben? And so,
no, he was supposed to have been gone longer.
No, was he?
Yeah, he got back early.
Oh. Okay, yeah. So he gets back.
We thought he'd come back the next day, I thought.
No, he was going to come back just after a while. And we were all just joking around. Like, oh, I wonder if hopefully Ben's smart enough not to run the vehicle out of fuel. And so we're eating, and Ben comes back, and he just, like, doesn't talk to anyone, no eye contact. And I go, you didn't run the vehicle out of fuel, did you, Ben? Just joking around. And he's like, real quiet, and then we do our thing, and we're eating, and he comes up to me and goes, Remy, I need to have some words. And I thought Ben was pissed that we were making him the grunt, like, I'm sick of carrying your crap, I'm not going to go up the mountain for tar. I'm like, oh, great, now he's going to quit on us.
Yeah.
And then I'm like, we've got this big production crew, the pressure's on me, because I'm kind of orchestrating the whole inner dealings out there.
Doug's been in that position.
Yeah, and thinking, I'm like, oh, great, these guys are going to be pissed, he's going to quit. And he goes, Remy, I don't know how to tell you this. And I'm like, yeah. And I'm expecting him to just be like, I'm sick of carrying crap and charging batteries. And he goes, I shot your truck. And I look at him and go, what do you mean you shot my truck? And I'm like, are you okay? He's like, yeah, well, I was sitting there. And his vehicle, I guess the power plug wasn't working or something. So he gets in my vehicle. He's sitting in the passenger seat, and we had shot some geese we had the shotguns ready for shooting geese. And he goes, you know, in Oz we don't have semi-automatic weapons. And this dude's an engineer. He's a smart guy.
And yeah. We don't have those kind of
guns in Australia.
So I was trying to figure out how it works.
Yeah, so he goes, I figured out how it works. So he's sitting there and he's just charging batteries for a few hours, just bored, and he says he's sitting there, he pulls the thing back, you know, the action back, looks in there, pulls it back, and you're just sitting there flicking the action, click, 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 you know, looks in a few times, nothing. Oh, there's a button on the bottom. Hits the button, hears a noise, huh? And he's sitting there, click, 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 flipping the action back and forth out of boredom, decides to reach down and pull the trigger. Well, there had been shells in the magazine. Not in the chamber. We didn't leave it loaded, but,
no.
You know, it's fine.
And we thought it was all adults.
Yeah. I mean,
we thought it was adults.
Yeah.
That we were in it with adults.
Exactly. I mean, you know, I leave shells in my magazine. It's not wherever we're at. It's not illegal or anything. And he pulls it back, pulls the trigger, boom, through the floorboards, blows out the fuel lines. And he said that when it went off, it was like shell shock. He opens the door, and he just, with his arms on the ground, it would have to scare you half to death.
Oh, it'd be so loud.
And then not only that, but now smoke's billowing out, and we're 25 something miles back.
We towed that car 20 some miles.
I told him that I always knew Australians were good shots because they could shoot a truck while it's running. But yeah, so we had to tow that view and multiple river crossings over rough terrain.
He's lucky he didn't blow his toe off.
Oh, well, that's why I always set the barrels, you know, barrels down. But
do you know my dad carried shotgun pellets in his foot?
That's what you're saying.
Yeah.
For just
ever.
Got shot, yeah. Well, I think, no, I'll tell, I'm giving a talk tonight at the university. I'm going to talk about that story for a minute, so I don't want to.
Yeah, don't want to ruin it.
Yeah, I don't want to blow it because you guys might be the only people there. You like, that sumbitch talked about this earlier.
Remember, the worst, though, was towing. How long did it take? About 8 hours to get the vehicle back?
Took forever.
All day. It was all day.
And then we realized
I was steering the back vehicles, just sucking diesel fumes. You're a soldier sucking diesel fumes with me for 10 hours. I felt so sick after
and
that.
If I remember right.
So sick.
I repeatedly brought up the idea that we should cut a piece of vacuum hose and patch the line. And someone kept saying, maybe you, that once you run these kind of vehicles out of gas, that doesn't work.
Well, because of the diesel engine, they're built on compression.
They fixed it and said that's not true. You can fix it.
Right. And I didn't. Yeah. Well, I don't think we could.
I was accidentally right.
You were accidentally right because we didn't have the proper tools to fix it. Because remember how bent the fuel? I mean, everything was.
I had no idea what I was talking about, but ended up.
Well,
being accidentally
right. It was more of a general like, can we just pull something from somewhere else and patch it up?
Yeah. And theoretically,
we could have. I'm not a very good mechanic. No, that's
I bet you're a better mechanic than I am.
I doubt it.
Maybe we should have a contest. But I want Yanni got any wrap up because I want to talk about why Remy came back.
Quick wrap up to some people listening because I know I grew up in Michigan and we couldn't even have the ammo like within arm's reach. I think of the gun in the car. Is it the rule something like
fully
that?
Fully enclosed case. Yeah.
Yeah.
Not in this state anymore.
Well, anymore
because the great governor here. Got it, where you don't need to have your gun case.
That's right. No matter what else, you don't have to case your gun anymore.
Back east, it's very strict rules on that. And then you move out west, and it's like in a couple of years, you're used to just having, you know, whether it's, shells in your magazine of your shotgun or, rifle cartridges, down in your bolt-action rifle in the backseat of the truck. It's like totally normal, right? We just drive around like that. Grab your gun and
out west, I think. When did I get my first shotgun? I think I was 8, 9. And I was like, here's a shotgun. And they're like, you can keep it in your room, but you can't have shells in the magazine. And I was like, but we can have them in the magazine when we're driving around. Yeah. My mom drew the line. She's like, you can have the gun in your room, but you cannot have shells in the magazine.
We had guns when we were so young, man. It just seems weird now, man. We drive around on our bikes with slung 22s. And like, I remember I didn't even understand at the time, but certain kids weren't allowed to hang out with us.
Because you guys were
roll
the
up on our bikes with like those tube-fed Marlin 22s over our shoulders. Just like, let's go.
Yeah. But remember, at that time, you just felt so old. You're like, I'm 8. I can have a shotgun.
Yeah.
You know, I was like, okay.
Yeah, your dad, my dad would just be like, don't shoot robins.
Yeah.
We had a long list of birds we were allowed to shoot. Now, I'm embarrassed to even say what was on that list, but chickadees and robins were off. We're not on the list. So, one other thing, though. The meat there is good, though. The tar.
Oh, it's some of my favorite.
When we killed a tar, we made tar-barbecue. Tar. That was fun. All right, that's not what I want to talk about. So, Remy, you came back in town because your new show was on.
Exactly.
Now, when I met Remy when I went to hunt in New Zealand with him. You had already been doing some television.
Yeah, I'd been doing Solo Hunters for about a year, 2 years, something like that by then. Yeah.
Yeah, I wanted Remy to come on and be like when I was on vacation, I wanted Remy to host Meat Eater. But instead, he's got his whole new damn show now.
I'll still come on. I'll just be like, today we're going to cook up. What's the worst thing you could think of to eat? We've already eaten a coyote, and I saw you eat a monkey. Is there anything
just for
left?
Here, it's just folks.
Yeah. I think that can be arranged.
No, red fox and hedgehog are on the list.
Not hedgehog. Yeah. Groundhog.
Groundhog.
Hedgehog you've already eaten?
Hedgehogs live in England.
You can't kill a hedgehog; they're too adorable.
Well, whatever the one is back east,
woodchucks and groundhogs.
Yeah,
woodchucks. Same damn thing.
We might be able to arrange a woodchuck.
We'll go out because that's a varmint. It's a good time of year to get them too. They spend a lot of time out of their burrow right now.
Yep.
So, anyways, now Remy's been working with same folks who make Meat Eater to launch a new show, Apex Predator. Talk about that.
Yeah. I mean, what my thought was, I think if you watch Apex, Apex Predator is just a show you have to watch to understand.
Yeah.
Because it's not necessarily a hunting show. And especially coming from a guy like me, my life is hunting. But
straight hunting.
Straight hunting. I mean, I guide for a living. I write for Western hunting articles and magazines. I do solo hunters,
yeah,
which
Remy,
is all
hunting. Oh, I want to bring this up. I got to – here's. I wound up knowing you from reading your articles in Western Hunter.
Right, and which is
and
funny.
I said, I want to meet this guy because you'd write great articles. I remember you had a great article about – like you do a lot of stuff like self-guided stuff, how to like get away from the crowds – backcountry junk. You read this. You had this really cool article about like trying to find like hunt mule deer in high pressure areas in Nevada.
Yeah, it's funny that when I got the first email from you, you were talking about hunting in Montana. I think, you know, looking for some ideas in Montana. I was like, I'm going to New Zealand in a month or so. Want to join me? Like, yeah, sounds.
I think
awesome.
I might even got your contact from Chris Denham.
I think
at Western Hunter Magazine.
Yeah, which is funny because you sent the email. You know, you. And I'd watched now I can't even remember the name.
Wild Within.
Yeah, and I loved that show. And it was funny because I'd been talking about that show before I got your email. And then I was like, that's strange. The guy that's on that show just sent me an email. It was like the most random email I'd ever received, probably. But it turned out being pretty cool. You're able to go to New Zealand. And
yeah, so then we met. And I was like, yeah, I really wanted to work with you more. So, talk about Apex, though.
Yeah.
It's like, just give the, I mean, give what it is.
Okay, so.
Like, what it's a study on.
It's looking at the way humans have become the top predators. And there's a lot of factors that go into it. But I have this thought that we can look at, like, if you look at every animal on the planet, they all fill a niche. They're specially adapted. They do something specific to survive, and that's how they get by surviving. Whether it's a predator animal or a prey animal, they all fill a certain spot, and they're all really good at something. But as humans, we can look at something that nature has specialized in and try to mimic it for our own hunting tactics, our own hunting style. Or it really, like, the more we do the show, it amazes me how much we actually compare or can compare to these animals that we think are way out of our league or hunt so different than us. We've taken a lot of tactics and a lot of things from a lot of different aspects in nature. And one of the things that got me thinking about doing a show like this, I was hunting elk in Montana, and it was the very first time I saw a wolf. And I'm walking, and I see this wolf. Wow, it was 30 yards away. And at this point, this is before you saw wolves in Montana.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, now it's, yeah, this was like
mid-90s.
I mean, I was ecstatic. I'd never seen a wolf in my life, and this was awesome. And it was just kind of looking at me. I get my video camera out. I'm like trying to film it. And I'm like, cool, I saw a wolf today. So I go, and I'd been stalked.
Where was that?
This was in the Bitterroot Valley in Montana.
Do you remember what year it was?
I can think it was 2002.
Okay.
Yeah, something like that. Maybe 2000. Yeah, 2000. And, you know, so I see this wolf, and I'd been hunting this specific bull elk. I'd passed up a lot of elk. I was hunting one big bull that was behind my place. So I see the elk out on this far ridge. So I walk around, and I get set up, and I'm on the backside of this ridge, and the herd elk's there. Well, sure enough, here comes the wolf hunting the same elk. And I only saw the one, so I don't know if he was just hunting alone, which a lot of people always talk about him hunting in packs. All the elk that I've witnessed get killed by wolves have been single wolves.
Is that right?
Yep. Never seen a pack attack wolves. I've seen four elk killed personally, like just visually watched elk getting killed. They've all been by single wolves.
You're shitting me.
No.
That's interesting.
Two cows, two bulls, two spikes.
Hmm.
Yep, two cows, two bulls. And so anyways, the wolf goes and gets the elk running. And I'm like, damn it. And it's a hot, it's one of those early September days. But I thought, in my mind, I was like, I know this area so well, I know where those elk are going. And they had this up and down, up and down, up and down. And you watch them come up just after the first rise. their tongues are hanging out. You've seen it, you know, like they get, it's like running a horse uphill. They get tired fast. A lot of people don't, you think like, you could never catch up to an elk. And I thought, I'm just going to run straight up this ridge and try to cut them off. So I literally started sprinting to the top. And I get to where, I mean, it's probably, I think it's 5-6 miles away. But I just ran up to the top, took my route. I could see them going up and down the ridges. And I get to the spot where I think they're coming up, and they are dead tired. By this point, they're walking. Their tongues are hanging out. You can see the veins in their face. Like, they just look gassed. And I stand behind a tree, and all the elk start walking by, just looking about half dead, tired, at probably the furthest were 20 yards. I whip out my camera, I take a few pictures, and the bull never showed up. And I think what happened was, because his antlers were so heavy,
he took a different route.
He went down, because I ended up walking down and seeing two other bulls that were smaller, lower. But it just put into my mind at that point, that's exactly how the wolf would have hunted him. And I would have never thought in a million years you could catch up to a herd. Everybody says, once you spook elk, they're gone 10 miles. You'll never find them again.
Well, there's some validity to that, because a lot of people aren't going to.
Right. But in heavy timber, it's fairly open country. But they do get gassed. I mean, they don't have the ability to sweat like we do, or they're a large animal running in the heat up and down steep mountains. And just by knowing the terrain and other things, I was able to catch up to him, and had the bull gone that route, I would have killed it. You know, I got some cool pictures. I still have that picture on my fridge. It was like the first time. And then walking, so fast forward a few years, I was out guiding one day, and as a guide, you have to get really good at killing elk in a certain amount of time. So you know, like, you can't mess up. You know where they hide, where they do this, you have to know them so well, because each week we're killing two public land elk for 10 weeks, which you just got to be on it. So I know these elk pretty well, and I have certain routes that I walk in certain mountains, because I know where they prefer. Like, you look at the whole mountain, the elk will be in one spot. They could be a million acres, and they're going to be on 100 of it.
Yeah, and you get the sense that if you killed every elk on that mountain range and let new elk come in,
they would do the same thing.
They would be
thing.
In the same spot.
Right. And I have a certain way that I walk this ridge, because I know the way that the thermals go in the morning, the winds, the way that I can come in through the trees and be hidden at this point where they like to bed. Then I walk up and do this. So I'm walking my route, which has worked forever, and I see some wolf tracks. And it surprised me. The wolf was hunting that mountain the exact same route that I take.
All right.
So here's another hunter that hunts every day. And it's like, I figured out something. Like, it was just like, we are so similar. We hunt. He knows where these elk bed to. He knows the route. He knows. And we're hunting them in the exact same fashion. It was crazy to me.
Yeah, it's interesting.
And so I started thinking about it and thought, okay, what other animals can we learn from or emulate? Like, if I had just watched how the wolf did things, I would probably come to the conclusion that it took me 10 years to figure out this route. And here, he's hunting every day. He has this knowledge. And as predators, we do things in a very similar way. And so I thought, what other animals are out there that I can learn from? What tactics can I take away from an alligator or a great blue heron or a river otter?
You know what's funny? We one time were in Michigan's UP, and we watched river otters catching fish. We're like, what the hell are they catching? We realized they're catching giant perch out of this river. Yeah. We later went back and caught perch.
Really?
We'd have never known about that spot if it wasn't for those otters.
Just watching.
I had no idea, dude.
And you could probably see where the lines and the, like, you know how fish will hold. It's the same even in a river. Certain fish will hold certain currents.
Yeah.
Because what I do a lot, before I go, if I go to a new river, I put on a snorkel and I float down the river and see visually where the fish are and how they're holding
what kind
currents.
Of stuff they like. Yeah.
And then I go and walk up that river and I catch 10 times the amount of fish, because I know exactly where those fish are sitting. Like, I know the seam to cast it because you know where the big fish are in the river.
No, I totally understand.
And other
that,
things.
Yeah.
But even just by, if you just watch the otter, like, what lines is he taking? Because that's the line where the fish are holding.
Yeah.
you can learn a lot.
So how many predators you, like in Apex Predator, how many predators you guys explore?
So far we've done six. And when we were talking about name, you know, I see it as looking at all of nature, other things, not necessarily predators, because I think that there's prey animals that could, I mean, think of our camouflage patterns and other things.
Yeah.
I mean, it's not just humans are essentially an apex predator. And I first want to look at predators, but also take a look at other animals that necessarily may not be apex predators or could be predators, could be non-predators. But so far we've looked at the golden eagle, the wolf, the river otter, the great blue heron, and that Catlin painting about the wolf skins, which...
Dude, yeah.
Yeah, he helped me.
Yeah, there's a famous Catlin painting where it's, he painted a... It's two dudes, right?
Yep.
Two Plains Indians hiding under wolf skins.
And that... See, that right there is looking
to approach a herd of buffalo. Yeah.
And that falls within the way that we're looking at it, because obviously they observed animal behavior and figured out a way to make it work for them.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, as you mentioned in that episode, the bison, when they see an upright human, know that if they run, they're safe because the humans can't catch them. But if they run from the wolf, the way the wolf hunts is by getting it to run. If they stand there, the wolf won't attack them because it knows it's outweighed, outmatched. So they saw, oh, when the wolves are there, the bison stand there. Let's throw a wolf skin over our back, and then we can spear them or shoot them with our bows or whatever.
Yeah, no, that has to be just like direct observation.
Direct observation.
Yeah.
And then there's the thought of, well, the first episode was the alligator. And
that one, like, what days is Apex on? It's on sport.
Thursday, 8 p.m.
Yeah, so it's same. I feel like it's the same slot. It's the same slot as Meat Eater.
Yeah. So that's what I'm just riding your wave.
Yeah, Meat Eater's not on the air right now, but Apex is on the air right now. You guys only run one. It's probably on repeat a little bit.
Yeah, it's 8, and then it's sometime in the morning, and then whatever.
So you did the alligator one, which is cool as hell.
The alligator. And then this week...
Talk about that. Talk about, like in the alligator one, like, Remy hangs out with people who know a lot about alligators. They kind of talk about their strat. How would you describe an alligator's hunting strategy?
I describe an alligator strategy as they're a lion weight predator. But the way I see it is they're a living trap that goes and sets themselves. It's just like... Yeah, what good. I could relate their hunting strategy to the best is either trapping or stand hunting. They aren't... a spot and stock type animal. Where a lion sees the prey, sneaks in and kills it. The alligator is just based on patience. And that's something Western hunters like myself do not have. Yeah. I have happy feet. when you can go 100 miles, if someone's like, you can go 100 miles if you wanted, and you're going to go 100 miles.
No, I'm a chronic. I shouldn't say to my own detriment because it makes me happy.
Yeah.
But like, at times, to my own detriment, as a guy that wants to be a successful hunter, I walk too much. But then I can't be like, what, I should be less happy?
Right.
I should be less happy and walk less. It's like, I just like to walk.
Right.
But anyways, yeah, they don't. Gators.
No, the gators don't. And then, so we set up the task. The way the show is we set up, I wouldn't even call them challenges. Because what I'm trying to do is learn from the lens of that animal. Because originally, well, you know, when you're starting a new show, you've got these ideas in your head of how it's going to work out.
Yeah.
And it just doesn't ever happen like that. Especially, like, let's go try to grab a pig with my hands in the swamps of Florida. And the focus was on the task of grabbing the pig. And what it turned out to be was learning from the alligator. And I was like, yeah, that should be the point. What am I trying to learn here? Because it was about the patience. It was about setting the trap and really blending in with the environment. Because the way the show works is we look at the animal and then we go and do what I like to call the training aspect or the human comparison aspect, where we compare humans to that animal.
Yeah, difference? Why can the alligator lay in the water?
Right.
For so long and his vision's good, and like, what makes it that you can't lay in the water like that?
Yeah.
With you, it's like freezing your ass off.
Well, yeah, you think about it. Humans can get hypothermia in 70-degree bath water, which is, you think about it, oh, yeah, right. No, you do. Your body does degrade, and there is when we did the test with the broad jump and the body temperature. Your body temperature goes down pretty fast, and you lose your heat quickly. You lose your full physical potential within 5 minutes. Not saying that you couldn't perform the task, but you aren't what you. Where the alligator could sit, they sit out all day, and they can conserve that energy for hours and hours and hours because they have a slow heart rate. They're cold blooded, so they heat up, and then they kind of they essentially assume their environment. And that's a lot of this show. I find things that are very similar between animals that kind of put into the perspective of me as a human of how to assume the environment and be more natural. You think about, you ever be out hunting and an animal just like looks in your direction or whatever and it knows you're there and you think, how does this animal even know?
Yeah. They look right through you and they can't register it.
Right.
Yeah.
And I think it has a lot to do with how even walking, like there's certain people that walk through the woods and the animals start running, or another person that can walk through the woods and it doesn't bother them. Mm-hmm. And I think it's a lot of how you meld into your environment. And
the kind of movements,
how familiar you are with the area and the land and other things. But there's a lot of things that I've noticed throughout predators that I wouldn't have noticed without doing this. And a lot of it is just blending with your environment, being comfortable, and a lot of things about us as humans that, oh man, we actually are a lot better at some of these things if we could train to do it as well as some of these other animals.
Yeah, like in your guys' wolf episode, when's that, Aaron, coming up?
That's coming, yeah, that's not this next one, but the following.
So in this wolf episode, Remy's exploring the idea of chasing elk like a wolf does.
Yeah.
Right. Just like that you just get on them and just go and go and go and go and go.
And eventually catch them.
And eventually catch them. And Remy goes into this place to test his
VO2 max.
It's like how well you take and process oxygen, right?
Yeah, it measures your endurance capabilities. It doesn't necessarily measure it's just like your endurance potential. So what you could potentially do if you trained up to it.
Yeah. Like how well you can pull in to restore depleted muscle with oxygen.
Exactly. Yeah. And where your body goes
anaerobic. And you had a good score. But then the dude tells you what a wolf has.
And you can't even compare to it.
Yeah. It's like you're just not gonna.
Right.
You
aren't gonna compare.
You're never gonna run like a wolf.
No.
We're going to start breeding that India, I guess.
Yeah.
Maybe.
Well, a lot of
kids
that.
Kids or grandkids.
What is what was yours and what's the wolf's? Do you remember?
Yeah, well, my VO2 max was like 83.3, and a wolf's can be over 300. But then, see, the other thing that I learned, though, is some of the stuff, a lot of it's just genetic or. Because the 83.3, I guess they did like. Lance Armstrong was like 86 while he was blood doping.
Yeah.
Or something like that. Like it's in mine. Just so happened to be
preternaturally high.
Naturally high. It's just like in the top probably one percentile of people. But I think that's pretty genetic because my family's. I'm just in a family of endurance type athletes.
Yeah.
Even like my grandma's finished Ironmans over the age of 50.
Just last year.
Yeah. No, she's like 70 now, but she still goes every year for her birthday. She goes and hikes this. We hike this big mountain. It's like she'll do that forever, I would think, as long as she can. But a lot of it, yeah, and then there's aspects where you can't even compare to these animals. But we have the advantage of it all comes down to our brains. We can devise ways to improvise where these animals have to rely on their natural ability. We can strategize.
Yeah, borrow stuff.
Exactly. Borrow things, create things. And try to outthink things. You like to think you could outsmart an elk or a deer, but sometimes it's a lot harder than you anticipate.
I think it's a big part of hunting, though. I think that what's the show demonstrates to me like a type of reverence for wildlife that I think is essential for a hunter to have.
Yeah.
Like, I was talking about my old man earlier, like we'd have, you know, what we were supposed to shoot and didn't shoot. And he's been dead a long time. But I remember, like, he had such a, like, myopic vision about wildlife that if it wasn't a game bird, it was a Tweety bird.
Right, yeah.
no fault to him. Like, he didn't grow up in a hunting, you know, he invented hunting for our family. Right. You know, he didn't grow up in a hunting household. He was raised by, like, Italian immigrant grandparents, you know. Like, they just, like, the last thing on their mind was appreciating wildlife. They lived in Chicago, trying to make ends meet.
Yeah.
You know, very modest upbringing during the Depression, right? So he didn't learn that. Like, I try to teach my kids to, like, really love wildlife, you know. And I haven't introduced them to the idea of that there's desirable and non-desirable. You know, it's like, learn your birds. Yeah. Love wildlife. But like a lot of hunters, man, it's, like, really easy to get in that sort of, like, good guy, bad guy attitude about wildlife. I remember I duck hunted with some guys, and they had, in their mind, there was mallards, and there was the term scrap duck.
Right.
You know, which I think is like it's disrespectful.
Yeah.
It breeds a sort of disrespect to be that, like, oh, if there's no use to me, right, if this species is of no immediate use to me as a hunter, it doesn't warrant my observation.
Yeah, and I think there is that approach, but how many, I think a lot of hunters, well, maybe I'm just talking about myself here, but I love every aspect of being out there.
Yeah.
It's not just that one animal. It's hunters, a lot of, it's hard to explain to non-hunters because hunters love animals. I've always admired animals. That's the reason that I started hunting, because I liked animals so much. But for me, it was, I remember being a kid flipping through those animal cards or animal fact sheets. Like, I would collect them. I would, my thing was animals. I loved figuring out what they did, how they lived, and that's why when I got into hunting, it was, I could become a part of their system. And that's what really felt cool to me, is I liked the idea of, when I first went out hunting, almost this feeling of, when I shot a bird, it was now my bird that I was a part of, like, the birds that are out there. I could see the animals at a distance, but now hunting, it put me in that situation where that bird is now mine. Now I can eat that bird. And it was just this cool feeling of being a part of it, like immersed, not just looking at.
I was recently,
it's so hard to explain.
No, I was recently having this conversation. I was out hunting with a first-time hunter, and I was explaining that that I'm sort of the opposite of a Buddhist, you know, because – when I do, like, I'm interested. I try to be interested in all animals. I try to study all animals. But it always, for me, and just like Apex Predator, the show, it always winds up being like sort of like coming back around to, in some way, me.
Yeah.
Like, what does it mean for me?
Right.
Like, I love a piece of information that when you hear pines, like, you, like, if you're not a hunter, you might be out in the woods and hear a pine squirrel chattering.
Yeah.
You might just be like, oh, the pine squirrel's out chattering. And I hear it, but what I hear is that pine squirrel's pissed.
Right.
About something.
Yeah.
And he might be pissed about something far away. And I mean, he's not pissed about me. Something is pissing that thing off. It could be, I've heard him bark at elk. They really bark at bears, right?
Yeah.
So it's like, you hear that, and that's like sending a message to me. So I'm interested in pine squirrels. I've eaten them, but I don't like hunt pine squirrels. I'm interested in pine squirrels. I want to know everything I can know about them. I was fascinated to hear that they're a big predator of snowshoe hares, one of the leading snowshoe hare predators. Which
I did not know that.
Me.
That's crazy.
And that when they chirp, they're pissed at something, and it's not a noise you should ignore.
Yeah.
There's an animal over there making him real mad. So I love them for their own sake, but I do internalize it in some way where I'm like, okay, I like this animal, but what does he mean to me? What does he mean for me? The same way I've many times found dead animals and other interesting things by just observing. Like, you see a bunch of ravens up in a tree circling around, getting all excited.
Means
probably
something
dead laying over there.
Yep.
I have a multi-tool that I still own that I was just watching a bunch of ravens once and walked over there and found, you know, four moose hooves and a multi-tool.
Really?
Yeah. Some dude, like, gutted a moose and left his multi-tool laying there. And so I'm like, yeah, I dig ravens. I like their body language, and I just can't help but personalize it. And Apex Predator is cool because it acknowledges that. Like, you look at one like herons, you know.
Yeah.
What is the heron doing when he's standing out there? Like, why? Like, how does he do what he does?
You know, when he's hunting.
Yeah. So I'm saying, I mean, it's like you look at it, and it just is a reasonable question. Like, how does he do what he does?
Exactly.
So well,
and the other thing is, you look at the heron, and he just, how different does that bird look than other birds? Quite a bit different. Like, why is he look like that? Where, what process made him the largest?
Yeah.
What process made him, like, and you look at the way, and sometimes you look, like, I always thought my assumption of the heron, and just a naive assumption that I would see him when I'm out fishing, and I'd always
just
be.
Just so you guys know, Remy did an Apex episode on herons.
On herons. Yeah. And so one of the reasons I wanted to do the heron is because I remember seeing that bird and thinking, like, as a kid, going, it's a dinosaur. It looks crazy. And then as a fisherman, how many times you're out there seeing a heron, and you almost kind of curse the heron, like, he's taking your fish.
Yeah.
You know, because you see him as, like, it's so easy. If I could just go spear these fish, I would have, like, and I've got this rod, and I'm having trouble catching fish, and I look over, and this heron's got a 5-pound trout lodged in its throat. It's about to die, you know? And you look at it, and I had this naive assumption that the heron, it was easy for the heron. He'd just spear these fish, and he could pretty much have his pick. Like, he was taking my fish. He barely had to work for it. So I kind of almost, I liked them, and I thought, wow, that'd be cool to be able to do. But I almost had this, as a fisherman, this weird, he's my competitor.
My dad used to have friends that were big trout fishermen, and they'd carry a pistol to shoot at river otters.
Yeah, and
so otters are getting all the fish.
And so doing this, I go, okay, so that my assumption going into the heron episode was, oh, this is a cruisy. I'm just going to be up there and spearing fish. And then I started watching, I really started looking at the herons, and most of the things they were eating is just small. Like, they were scrounging for their food. And then I go and attempt to be like the heron, which seems ridiculous, as I put some stilts on and get in the river. And I had so much trouble, it wasn't even funny.
Yeah.
And then I realized, I see why the heron's scrounging for food, because it's not easy.
Yeah.
Its life is not easy. It's a big body bird that has to catch a lot of food in difficult situations. So they'll catch anything.
Spend a lot of time hunting.
Exactly. I mean, they spend all day, a lot of times all night, just trying to scrounge up a meal. And when I thought it'd just be this cruisy mission of going out there and having all the advantage, you realize, okay, this is the heron's life. And then I learned a lot of things on, okay, yeah, you have to be patient. You have to pick your spot well. You have to take advantage of opportunities.
Yeah, trial and error.
Trial and
error,
yeah.
You know, my old man, he didn't make live wells. You know, like a washing machine, how they have the tub, perforated tub in a washing machine? He just pull steel ones, pull the steel tubs, and he used to make them out of steel.
Yeah.
And just set it in the water with a couple of bricks in it. If you guys are hearing like what sounds like just a constant scratching and rattling, that's Doug Dern playing with his headset.
Trying not to cough into the microphone.
All right, so my man had these steel wash tubs, and he used them for a live well. So we just set it in the water and put a couple bricks in the bottom to keep it from floating away. And as we caught bluegills on our dock where I grew up, we'd throw them in the live well. And then when it was enough to bother scaling them and flaying them, we'd scale them and flay them. And it's perforated, so they're getting aeration, you know?
Yeah.
And the herons used to land way down the beach and pull a painstaking stalk.
On that tub.
On the live well. They never just got like,
they never understood that
I'm just
going to
land there and eat it. They're like, they land way down, and they just start sneaking and sneaking and sneaking, and they get up and whap. Bluegill, you know, fun to watch, man.
Yeah, that.
But they had to like reach over the edge, you know, to get down in there. But they pick it up, the vibration from the fish or something, you know.
Yeah, I think that, and they have almost like polarized.
But he's not seen through there.
He's not seen, so they're underneath,
under the water,
feeling the vibration
in a perforated steel tub. But I feel like they would, I don't know, they would just
feel the vibrations with their feet or something.
They would, they'd know that those fish were there.
Because that's what, even in the muddy water, there's a lot, like the herons would actually walk and kick up small prey, and then they would essentially jab where they thought
it's
going.
Like a bonefish does.
Yeah, they just kind of like push things up with their feet, and then as they felt it swim away, go for it. But it's a lot. They also have to deal with things that we have to deal with as well, like water refraction and other things that make it hard spearfish underwater when you're above, and then imagine not having good water visibility or clarity or low densities.
Yeah,
just makes it, it's a hard knock life for the heron when you think, you look at him on the beach going, oh
yeah, dude,
that bastard, dude, he's got it made. And that's not the case all the time.
Yeah, no, that's good stuff, man. So Thursdays
Thursday, 8 p.m. Watch it. And then what's really cool is if you don't have television.
Oh, we forgot to say. It's on sports. It's on, it's the, same, it's on the same network.
Yeah, same network, same time.
Sports
8 p.m. So yeah. If you, I wonder, you maybe have TiVo Meat Eater. Like maybe I wonder if it's on that time slot or if it's on the name. And it may just pop up. It's probably on the name though. But if you are a Meat Eater fan, which most people listening I imagine are, you can just tune into the same bat time, same bat channel. Get
right.
The show.
And if mugs want to check you out on Twitter, Facebook, what should they do?
At Remy Warren or Apex Predator TV. But see, I'm more of a non-traditional media user myself.
Yeah.
Traveling all the time, like to watch stuff on Netflix, internet-based stuff. So the bonus part is if you don't have the network or you don't have TV, you can go to apexpredator.tv and just click on buy the episode or the season. And the time it airs...
Is that a VHX deal?
VHX deal.
Oh, okay.
So when it airs on Sportsman's Channel, like that week, you get it in your inbox.
Yeah, so you can go...
You don't have to wait till the end of the season. You get it that night, Thursday.
No, because Meat Eater's like meateater.vhx.tv.
Go to apexpredator.tv.
That's it?
Yep, and then there's the link for the VHX. It's all right there. And yeah, you get it, and I think it downloads it 8:30 p.m. You can stream it or download it.
Exactly. Can you buy a single episode?
You can buy a single episode, or I'm pretty sure you can get the seat.
What's a single episode worth?
$2.99.
Sweet.
Worth checking out. And you don't have to wait till the end. You just, while everyone else is watching it, you just wait 30 minutes, boom.
Yep.
You got it. For those that don't have television, which there's probably quite a few out there that don't. I didn't for the longest time. So.
$2.99. It's worth that. Yeah. You'll learn that much worth of stuff.
Yeah.
Definitely. So. If you want to see those old Meteor episodes with Remy and Steve in that sweet New Zealand country we were talking about, you can go to meateater.vhx.tv, and it's in volume 3.
Or if you go to themeateater.com, you'll find links to go find and download those episodes.
Yeah.
And we sell, like, Meat Eaters are up in these little blocks of, they're all in one block.
The New Zealand ones.
You can buy all the New Zealand shows, and you'll be able to see, like, a lot of the stuff we covered about New Zealand. It's like, if you watch those all together, you'll kind of get, you'll get the picture of New Zealand.
Those are some of my favorite episodes.
They're good, man.
Just the visual, it just looks awesome.
Yeah.
Well, and then Crossing the River was pretty sweet. Yeah. I rewatch those ones all the time. I'm like,
they're great, man. We had Mo.
Yeah, he did.
Diamond Mo Fallon, man.
Done a good job.
He's like just a great, great cinematographer, and he shot those episodes, and they're beautiful, man.
We shouldn't have tied that rope to you, but
I don't care.
We did it. Gone and done it.
Yeah.
Step one, never tie yourself to a rope across a river.
I don't know. Live and tell the tale.
Exactly.
All right, concluding thoughts, Yanni? Oh, Yanni's got his Hunt to Eat t-shirt on. Go to what is it? HuntToEat.com?
Yep.
Go buy one of Yanni's t-shirts. HuntToEat.com.
Thank you.
That's Yanni's concluding thought, Remy.
I'm going to go buy a Hunt to Eat t-shirt. And then...
Are you really?
Yeah.
Don't lie.
I like this one.
Yanni never has them in stock. He sells them out faster than they can print them.
They look pretty sweet.
We have some that... Hopefully, by the time this podcast airs, we'll be back in stock. Yeah,
they should be back in stock.
Like
HuntToEat.com, buy Remy's buy Yanni's t-shirts.
And then,
because then Yanni's gonna take all of his money and invest it in Wealthfront.
There you go.
and bicycles.
and fantasy football or baseball. And then he's gonna come out in New Zealand.
Concluding thoughts?
Yeah, I mean,
Don't worry about Yanni hunting.
Oh, I'm not worried.
Because Yanni used to be a hunting guy, then he came to work with us. But the other day we had a day off.
Just blasting turkeys.
Goes out, got a turkey.
See?
Living life. Don't worry about that, kid. All right, concluding thoughts?
If you have not seen Apex Predator, you have to check it out. And you can do so on apexpredator.tv or Sportsman's Channel.
So what's the website, though?
apexpredator.tv. Or www.apexpredator.tv. Easy.
Yeah, anybody can remember that.
Yeah, and then obviously, if we've got my favorite thing about the show is our web videos. If you want to have a good laugh or see something crazy, you have to check out our web videos.
Yeah, so go check out some content. You can see what Remy looks like.
We've got some.
You're not married
stuff.
Yet, are you?
I am not married.
Remy's still in the market.
I am single.
Wow.
Yeah.
Ladies.
You know what? But that's what you get when you travel around.
How old are you, Remy? 24/7.
I just turned 30 a few weeks ago.
Do you have a large investment portfolio?
Yeah, I've got a large portfolio, yes.
Okay, so Remy, he's got a huge investment portfolio. Single.
Four freezers.
Good-looking kid. Doug's married. Concluding thoughts?
I'm excited about this $299 deal on the Apex Predator because I don't have cable anymore, and so I'm in.
Did you buy one of Yanni's T-shirts yet?
That's the next thing I'm doing, 2XL.
We have those in stock.
All right.
How much are those?
In stock.
Same price as the other ones, $24.95.
Doesn't cost any extra to be a big guy.
So $25 plus $3 to buy one of Remy's shows, $28.
I got that money in my pocket. Can I get it right now?
You'll be looking good and watching good. All right. That's it. I don't have any concluding thoughts. My concluding thought is we get a lot of people who are always writing in to ask like a good bang for your buck elk hunt because they live in the East. They want to go out and do an elk hunt. Check out Remy too for that. You know, good elk hunts.
Yeah.
Affordable elk hunts.
I'm pretty jam-packed though.
All right. Never mind. Yeah. Don't go talk to Remy.
But
just go out and hunt Doug's place. Coming from the backside. Coming from the backside.
There aren't any elk there though.
Coming from the backside and shoot a giant whitetail on Doug's place. Go with a bow and hunt weekdays. You have your place to yourself. No one's going to hear enough to say nothing. All right, kids. Thank you for listening.